everyone, and thank you very much for joining us today. My name is Susie Gelman, and I'm privileged to serve as the board chair of Israel Policy Forum. If you are joining Israel Policy Forum for the first time today, I want to welcome you. And if you are a returning viewer, I want to welcome you back. I hope all of those of you who celebrate had a happy, safe, and sweet Rosh Hashanah. Israel Policy Forum is committed to advancing a viable two-state outcome to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in order to ensure Israel's security and its Jewish and democratic future. To all of our supporters on this program, thank you. If you view Israel Policy Forum as a vital resource, want to help ensure the success of our initiatives in the year ahead, and have not already done so, I encourage you to make a contribution today at www.israelpolicyforum.org/giving. Now on to today's program. Last week, we witnessed the signing of the historic Abraham Accords, normalizing Israel's relationships with the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. While it was once conventional wisdom that Israel could not have normal relations with the wider Arab world before peace was achieved with the Palestinians, this assumption has been significantly undercut by recent developments. Now there is the possibility that other Arab states in the Middle East and North Africa will join the UAE and Bahrain in normalizing with Israel, while others may still hold out longer. To help understand the current trajectory of events surrounding normalization and reactions from around the region, we are indeed fortunate to be joined today by Stephen Cook. Stephen is the Eni Enrico Mattei Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies and Director of the International Affairs Fellowship for Tenured International Relations Scholars at the Council on Foreign Relations. He is an expert on Arab and Turkish politics as well as American Middle East policy. Cook is the author of False Dawn, Protest, Democracy, and Violence in the New Middle East, The Struggle for Egypt from Nasser to Tahrir Square, which won the 2012 Gold Medal from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and Ruling But Not Governing, the Military and Political Developments in Egypt, Algeria, and Turkey. With that, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure to be with you. And let me just say before we start, I am a voracious consumer of Michael Koplow's columns. They're really terrific, and they are a great source. I don't agree with everything that Michael writes, but they're a great source of information on Israel and all things Israel-related.
So, Stephen, since the signing of the Abraham Accord last week, there's been much speculation about more states signing normalization deals with Israel, and expectations are growing that another handful of countries will reach agreements before the November 3rd presidential election. What, in your view, prompted the Israel-UAE deal now, and what does that tell us about which countries may be next in line?
It's a great question, Susie. And let me just start out by stepping back just a little bit. The United Arab Emirates and Israel have been inching towards normalization over the course of the last 3 or 4 years. In 2015, I guess it's 5 years, 2015, the Israelis opened a diplomatic office connected to the International Renewable Energy Agency there. Since then, Israeli athletes, Israeli cultural figures, the guy who's the lead actor from Fauda was welcomed and actually mobbed by people when he visited Dubai and was filming something there. Government officials have visited Abu Dhabi openly. And so this is something, and I should also add that Israel's been invited to take part in the Dubai Expo, which has been delayed until next year. These are all signs of a kind of mutual interest in the development of relations. And then, of course, on June 12th, the Emirati ambassador to the United States, Yusuf Al-Oteba, wrote an op-ed in Yediot Ahronot, which kind of laid out the Emirati vision of normal relations between the two countries, but for the fact that the Israelis were, at the time, saying that they would begin the process of annexation on July 1st. That caught the attention of a lot of people in Israel, and I think it made an impression upon the Emiratis how many people's attention it got. And from there, they started building out the idea of an agreement. And that agreement obviously came together in the last month or so, was presented up privately to the Trump administration and to the Israelis. There's also, I mean, and so, you know, that is essentially how it worked. But the timing is interesting. And I think that obviously annexation was something that was driving it, and that the Emiratis genuinely believe that this is an agreement that will stymie that process and take it off the table, as people said. All of their press releases said, we stopped annexation. There's also the political clock that's ticking here in the United States. And I think that the Emiratis are keenly attuned to that clock. And there's an opportunity here in separating themselves from the Saudis. There's an opportunity here for them to do something positive in the region that will win them accolades on both sides of the aisle, which should help them should there be a Biden administration. And there's also going to be goodies that follow from an agreement. The precedent that was set by the Egyptians and the Israelis back in 1979 is that the United States, regardless of how intimately involved it is in negotiating these agreements, pays. And generally how the United States pays is through the supply of copious amounts of weapons. The Emiratis, there's been lots of discussion of them getting F-35s, but there's also part of this deal, armed drones, long-range artillery, intelligence-type stuff. And these are things that they believe that they need, feeling vulnerable to the Iranian challenge in the region.
One of the hallmarks of the Israel-UAE agreement so far is that it looks as if it will spur robust relations not only between the governments, but between Israelis and Emiratis in a number of different spheres, from the economy to tourism. As you well know, being an Egypt expert, this has not been the case with the Israel-Egypt peace treaty, which is in many ways a treaty between the respective militaries that never filtered down to the societal level. What makes the Israel-UAE situation so different from the Israel-Egypt one? And is there any prospect for Israeli-Egyptian ties to advance beyond the cold ones that exist currently?
Well, we don't know yet how the Israeli-Emirati ties will unfold. If you go back to 1979, there was tremendous hope in Egypt. This was not a cold peace, as they say, from the very beginning. But I think that to the extent that the Palestinian autonomy talks, which going back to the late 70s and the Egypt-Israel peace treaty, to the extent that governments had, the Egyptian and Israeli governments had different interpretations of what this meant and the seriousness with which they took them, and then ultimately those talks failed or never really moved forward, it became apparent to Egyptians that this was a separate peace. And Egyptians paid a price for it. And there was no real, along with that, there was no real effort, especially after Anwar Sadat's assassination, to lead people towards normalization. We will see what unfolds with the Emiratis, but at least in the early going, the Emiratis are making a big difference in that the Crown Prince and the Foreign Minister and other officials have really taken it upon themselves to not only open their relations with Israel, but to normalize Judaism. Extraordinary that there was lots of discussion in the Emirates about Rosh Hashanah and the orders that hotels in the Emirates have to offer kosher options and pieces in the media about Judaism, which is part of Israel, but also separate from it. And I think that it may be a critical difference between the agreement between Egypt and Israel and the United Arab Emirates and Israel. But we will have to see. Of course, the Emirates is not a democratic country. People who oppose this agreement or oppose the government more generally end up behind bars. Thus far there hasn't been a significant outcry, but the Emirates is a very small country. People are generally, there isn't a large opposition movement there, but I think that there's a real opportunity here for Israelis and Emiratis to kind of break down some barriers, given the baggage of Egypt and Israel and the Palestinian issue that became impossible, and that perhaps it will rebound in other parts of the Arab world, whether it's Egypt or whether it's Saudi Arabia or someplace else, which have been notoriously hostile, not just to Israelis, but to Jews more generally.
Stephen, in contrast to what you were just saying about the Emirates tamping down any kind of dissent, it does seem that there is some degree of public dissent against the Bahraini government regarding normalization. Could you please explain to our audience the difference between Bahrain and the UAE when it comes to the ability of the public to respond to this or to make its views known?
Well, just in general, there's just more robust politics in Bahrain than there is in the United Arab Emirates. Part of that is structural. You have a ruling family and a small minority of Sunni that rule over a country that is anywhere estimated between 60 and 70% Shia, who don't have the kind of power that their demographic weight would suggest. And particularly, and there have been Shia uprisings and protests over many years, most recently to coincide with the Arab uprisings in 2011. That uprising has been met with an extraordinary crackdown, very, very harsh. And Bahrain has a civil society sector that has been pushing against the authoritarian measures that the Bahraini government has taken. And the normalization agreement between Bahrain and Israel is an opportunity from which to take on the government. It is brave of those who have spoken out against the normalization agreement in Bahrain because of the real crackdown that has gone on there for the last 10 years. You never really saw that in the Emirates. Perhaps it's because the Emirates are much more efficient in terms of their security, which is, I think, closer to the truth. But there, the kinds of political problems that have plagued Bahrain for a very long time just don't exist in the United Arab Emirates.
Given the close relationship between Jared Kushner and Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, otherwise known as MBS, and the fact that Bahrain would not have normalized relations with Israel absent Saudi approval, many are wondering whether or not Saudi Arabia is going to be the next to establish formal ties. What are the constraints, in your opinion, on MBS that have prevented him from normalizing relations with Israel so far? And do you expect that it might happen before our election in November?
The biggest constraint on Mohammed bin Salman is daddy. Daddy does not, the king does not want to normalize relations with Israel. In fact, and the king's half-brother, King Abdullah, said that Saudi Arabia would be the last country to sign a peace agreement with Israel, working to ensure that other peace agreements are to the liking and consistent with the Palestinian cause. So there is a real divergence, but as long as King Salman remains alive and is of a generation that feels very strongly committed to the Palestinian cause, the Saudis can only go so far. Yes, it's true, because Bahrain is basically a wholly owned subsidiary of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the King of Bahrain did have to seek approval, and the Saudis, nod, nod, wink, wink, approved it. The Emiratis let the Saudis know what they were doing, but don't face the same kind of constraints as the Bahrainis. It's notable that the Saudis have, despite King Salman's opposition to normalization of relations with Israel before the establishment of a Palestinian state and justice for the Palestinians, have said aircraft flying between the United Arab Emirates and Israel, and presumably also Bahrain, that can cross Saudi territory. So that is a step in the direction. But I would not expect there to be any change in the status of the under-the-table relationship between Saudi Arabia and Israel before the November 3rd election or any time thereafter. Let's have this conversation after King Salman dies. And also, at that time, we'll also have to assess how far Mohammed bin Salman has gone in consolidating his power, which is a multi-year process. It seems like he has, but it's not that he is not without constraints. His biggest constraint on this issue is his father's opposition, but there are other constraints within the kingdom. So it's not like if King Salman were to die next week, MBS would open up and Saudi Arabia to Israelis. That's, I don't think, in the cards. Right now, the Saudis feel comfortable with the confluence of interests with Israel on the Iranian threat to both of them.
One of the obvious losers of the past few weeks has been Turkey. Despite having its own relations with Israel, Turkey criticized the UAE for going down the same path and is increasingly trying to portray itself as the regional champion of the Palestinian cause. How does Turkey fit into this larger regional picture, and is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict just another arena for the Turkish-Qatari axis and the pragmatic Sunni states to battle for influence, Or is there something special about the Palestinian cause that is important to Turkish regional ambitions?
There's a lot packed in that terrific question, Susie. Let me start by saying that the Turkish effort to elevate the Palestinian issue in Turkey's own domestic political discourse and regionally is something that has been going on for quite some time. Not long after the Justice and Development Party came to power in 2002, it began talking more and more about the Palestinian issue. That's because Turkey, under the Justice and Development Party, sees itself as a leader of the Muslim world, and to the extent that the Palestinian issue is a Muslim cause, it was important that that party and its leadership talk about it. Of course, in 2006, they developed relations with Hamas, and part of Turkey's soft power, the Arab world, leading up to the Arab uprisings in 2010 and 2011, was President Erdogan's, then Prime Minister Erdogan's, willingness to say things about the Palestinians and Israel's conduct in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip that Arab leaders like Hosni Mubarak or the King of Saudi Arabia or the King of Jordan were unwilling to do, unwilling to say, because they wanted to preserve their relations with the United States. And the way to preserve their relations with the United States was to have basically correct relations with the Israelis. Since that time, the Turks have mucked about in Jerusalem and so on and so forth to maintain its position as a leader of the region. But in the last decade, Turkey has become isolated in the region, a process that began in 2013 and that has continued to this day. And you're quite right. They are, if not a loser, but increasingly isolated. And their argument about the United Arab Emirates is freighted with hypocrisy. For all of the problems in the Turkish-Israeli relationship, for all the deep freeze of diplomatic relations, the single biggest international flag that flies in and out of Ben Gurion Airport is Turkish Airlines. Everybody I know who's traveling to Tel Aviv likes to fly on Turkish Airlines because they can get a great deal. Or the business class is terrific, especially in comparison to United or El Al. There is significant commercial relations. Turkish business likes doing business with Israel. There remains some contacts at the intelligence level. It's discreet and quite obviously compartmentalized, especially since the Israelis regard Turkey as a threat. And the Israelis look at Turkey and say, you know, since our relations began to deteriorate, we've done really well in the region. We have terrific relations with Cyprus. We have terrific relations with Greece. Our relations with Egypt has improved. And look at what we've done in the Gulf. It's not just the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. Prime Minister Netanyahu went to Oman. There are these under-the-table relations with Saudi Arabia. And this has really left Turkey and, by association, Qatar isolated. But the Turks are more isolated than the Qataris because at least the Qataris cooperate with the Israelis in Gaza. And the Israelis prefer dealing with the Qataris than actually with the Turks. So, and now, of course, in response to the Abraham Accords, the Palestinians are seeking support from the Turks. This seems like a very bad idea for the Palestinians because you have a country that is isolated in the region. Countries are coalescing against Turkey in the region, yet the Palestinians are now seeking support and relief through the Turks, which is not really going to get them anywhere.
I just want to remind members of our audience, if you have a question, please type it in the Q&A box. And we have a number already, which I'm going to get to after I ask one more question of Stephen. So building on what you just said, Stephen, Turkey has been very vocal in opposing normalization. How does Ankara square that position with the fact that Turkey has official diplomatic and commercial ties with Israel?
It doesn't. It hopes everybody forgets about it because those relationships have been bad for quite some time. Now, there are no relations at the ambassadorial level, and neither Israel nor Turkey seem eager to change those relations. There's been some reporting out of Ankara suggesting that the Turks are aware of their regional isolation and that one way of breaking out of that is to reach out to Israel. Does not seem likely that President Erdogan could bring himself to do that at this point. And quite frankly, from the Israeli perspective, they're not willing to pay any price for their relations with Israel for precisely the reason, their relations with Turkey for precisely the reasons that I laid out. They've done so well in the region. They don't feel like they need them as much as they previously had needed relations with Turkey. There was a time when Israel had relations with Jordan and Egypt and Turkey, and that was it. And Turkey seemed like it was extraordinarily important for Israel in terms of expanding the circle of peace. But given the profile and posture of the Justice and Development Party, the Israelis have really come to the conclusion that Turkey is a threat. Erdogan would have to give up too much to Israel. He'd have to, you know, stop mucking about in Jerusalem. He would have to give up his relationship with Hamas, which is it's interesting, it's weird, but it's important to the Justice and Development Party. And I say weird in truly an analytic way, because the AKP looks at Hamas and sees itself in Hamas, which is, when you know the histories of both of them, is really quite extraordinary. Hamas coming out of the Muslim Brotherhood, the AKP coming out of an entirely different tradition, nonviolent, etc. So everyone would have to give up a lot to Israel, and the Israelis would have to sacrifice relations that they have, ones that they benefit from. Part of the motivation of the Israel-United Arab Emirates thing is not just concern about Iran and the exercise of Iranian power in the region, it's also concern about the exercise of Turkish power in the region. And you see the Emiratis moving throughout the region to check Turkish power, and the Israelis are obviously part of that, not declared, but certainly part of that effort.
So I'm going to get to our audience questions. I'm going to try to ask as many of them in the time we have. I'm going to start with Lara Jakes, New York Times, who asks if you'd please discuss the pros and cons for Sudan's transitional government in normalizing relations with Israel and the extent to which that appears tied to coming off the United States SST list, meaning terrorists?
It's a great question. And I'm going to start out with an anecdote. When I was a grad student and I was doing dissertation research and living in Egypt long term, I made connection with a vice president to Anwar Sadat, a guy named Ismail Sabri Abdullah. There's been a long time since, it was kind of shocking to sit with someone who had called themselves a former vice president of Egypt, given how long it had been since there had actually been someone called a vice president in Egypt. Anyway, in talking about the Sadat era, he said to me, look, Sadat understood very clearly that if you wanted to have good relations with the United States, these are his words, not mine. If you wanted to have good relations with the United States, you had to spend the night in Tel Aviv. And this is sort of a crude way of articulating the trilateral nature of the bilateral Egypt-US relationship. And I think the same logic prevails with Sudan. Sudan would want to come off the U.S. terrorism list. And what better way to do that than to make nice with the Israelis? Certainly, Israel has things that Sudan can offer, technology, expertise, know-how, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, Sudan coming off the terrorism list and becoming part of a wider circle of peace is a diplomatic victory for the Israelis. But clearly, the Sudanese are looking at this and tentatively looking at this. They did send a deputy ambassador to the White House last Tuesday. And one has to wonder whether the Sudanese are genuinely interested in the relationship with Israel, given the opposition it's likely to stir in Khartoum, and more interested in the attendant benefits of coming off the state-sponsored terrorism list. And that's clearly what's driving them. And clearly they know the best and easiest path there is through television.
Alexander Longarov asks, in the context of increased ties between Arab countries and Israel, does it make sense to operate a distinction between the Arab street and the Arab leaders? In this respect, how similar or different is the picture between Morocco and Oman?
Well, I think it's a good question. And I do kind of recoil at this idea of the Arab street because, you know, having been a resident in the Arab world for a long time in various places, there are definitely different views of the world and of this conflict. And clearly governments in the region are moving faster than societies are on this issue, if only because these societies have been conditioned in certain ways over many, many years. About the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. There are beliefs that are held that are very, very important to people politically, symbolically, and culturally. And those are very, very hard to break down, even if leaders are either being great statesmen or cynical and normalizing their relations with Israel. The way Moroccans look at the normalization of ties different from the way in which Omanis look at it? I would bet that in both countries, and I've most recently been in Oman, but pre-COVID, so none of my information is correct, is that there are a variety of views on this. But I would say that that even though the Palestinian issue has diminished in importance for many people across the Arab world, there still is something very important about justice for the Palestinians and the idea of a state for the Palestinians for themselves that I think runs across the region. I would think you'd find more agreement on that than you would on a variety of other issues related to this, to the core conflict between Israelis and Palestinians.
Our next question comes from Leon Horowitz, and it's sort of tied into what you were just saying. Instead of hyping the Abraham Accords as election stunts for Trump and Netanyahu, would it not have been more productive for the U.S. to have encouraged the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia to convince the Palestinians to come to negotiate once annexation, at least temporarily, had been taken off the table? Or is it the opinion of all these actors that the Palestinian leadership is far too corrupt and out of the picture for this to even be possible?
It's a great question. I think that, you know, I don't speak for any of the Gulf states. From their perspective, it wasn't an election stunt. For them, they were moving forward. This is in their interest. It happened to happen now than any other time. Maybe I live in the Washington, D.C. bubble, but I can't imagine any American anywhere voting based on the Abraham Accords. I think we just have just a range of other issues in this country that are mobilizing and animating people to vote. Be that as it may, I do think that the Gulf states would have hoped that if the Abraham Accords was going to, quote-unquote, stop annexation, for however long it does, whether it's permanently or not, that the Palestinians would then use that as an opportunity to say to the Trump administration and to the Israeli government, okay, let's explore some means of negotiation here in order to address our grievances in some way. And they were hoping the Palestinians would take this up, but they also don't have great relations with the Palestinians. Look, the Emiratis had sent COVID relief to the Palestinians and the Palestinians rejected it. Now, it doesn't help the Emiratis in that they, you know, who runs around Abu Dhabi and Dubai is Mohammed Dahlan, who is, you know, their alternative to Mahmoud Abbas. At the same time, this is a divided Palestinian leadership. It is a corrupt Palestinian leadership. And its decision to seek support in Ankara, I think, demonstrates how short-sighted they have been. I'm not saying they need to fall in love with Mohammed bin Zayed, but the Saudi king, after the Arab League meeting, instructed his foreign minister to come out and say, they did not censure the Emiratis, but they said, we fully support the establishment of a Palestinian state and the Palestinians achieving their rights. That's something for the Palestinians to work with. And they ran off to Ankara, which has sought to delegitimize the crown prince. That seems like a bad decision to me.
So as a follow-up to what the question you were just asked, Mark Pinakovsky asked, do you agree with the view that the Palestinian issue has lost its importance on the Arab's agenda writ large? Or do you think that the current normalization wave will see the Arab protagonists exert pressure on Israel to resolve the Palestinian issue?
It's a good question. And I just say, start with an anecdote and then get analytic. I spent 18 days in the Gulf a couple of years ago for my sins. And although the visit to Oman was really wonderful. No one really had much to say about the Palestinian issue. Whether I was meeting with government officials or others, no one really, this was not an agenda item for people. If it came up, it was because maybe I brought it up. Polling shows, Jim Zogby did some polling in 2019 and updated it in 2020 to the extent that he could, and he found that the Palestinian issue had fallen on the agenda. People still felt strongly about it, but it wasn't the top of their concerns. I think the hope is, and the Emiratis have said, look, we're not the Egyptians. We are not beholden to the United States. We don't need $1.3 billion subvention every year from the United States. We can halt this process if the Israelis don't perform. And they point to the fact that the Israelis assassinated a Hamas operative on their territory a number of years ago, and they shut down all their contacts with the Israelis. All security contacts with the Israelis were shut down after that. It's a little bit different now. So let's see. And they don't seem to be as committed to the Palestinian cause. They did, and all credit due, they stopped annexation. And I actually, you know, there's been a lot of commentary, oh, the Israelis weren't going to do it anyway. I saw the Israelis actually moving in that direction. I saw Netanyahu, as he was in political trouble, becoming more and more dependent upon annexationists. And you can imagine, even if he didn't really want to do it, and who knows what was going on in his head, I don't know him. But one could see, for political reasons, him having to go forward. So credit where credit is due with the Emiratis. But at the same time, these are people who are frustrated with the Palestinians and no longer want to make their national interests contingent upon progress in the Palestinian. And that's really what the Abraham Accords is about. The Emiratis and the Israelis see their national interests as advancing their national interests by having normal relations in all facets. First and foremost, security, commercial ties, and then it helps them both politically. In a town where things are very polarized, and Israel and the United Arab Emirates are the part of the red states of the Middle East, and anticipating some potential change, this is something that they both get credit for on both sides of the aisle.
And as we know, the Emiratis are getting something very significant in return in the guise of F-35s and other very highly advanced equipment, right, which I know has given certainly the Israeli security establishment heart failure. And Benny Gantz, I think, met with Secretary Esper today, I guess, to talk about the maintaining Israel's qualitative military edge. So clearly there's something in this for the Emiratis, something very major.
And for the Israelis, because I think a lot of this, you know, rending of clothing and not one screw is really part of a negotiation from the United States with the Israelis and the United States over what the Israelis are going to get on top of what they already get, because the Emiratis are going to get the F-35, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's coming as well.
So we have another question. George Goldstein is wondering, how much of the UAE-Israel rapprochement is due to their work, and how much is due to the United States?
I think this is much more of an Emirati-Israeli deal where the United States seals it for them by providing things like F-35s and whatnot. No one's going to make a deal in the Middle East between Israel and another strategic ally of the United States without it being under the auspices of the United States. But this is something that really happened in separate from or parallel to American efforts to kind of push countries in the region together. Of course, the Trump administration, in all fairness, had a policy in which they were looking at the so-called outside-in strategy. But as I pointed out, in 2015, the Emiratis and the Israelis were kind of exploring and feeling their way towards normalization. And I think the real push here was, as I said, the Ala Oteba op-ed in Yediot, and then the Israeli response to it, which they saw as an opportunity. And they were able to kind of craft something that the Israelis couldn't say no to, and that the United States obviously saw a benefit in as well. You know, in ways, it's perfectly consistent with how peace agreements have happened in the Middle East in the past. You know, we tell ourselves the mythology of, you know, Camp David, that we had some sort of like great, you know, role in it. But, you know, what happened between Egypt and Israel was really at the behest first of Anwar Sadat and the Egyptians and the Israelis together. Yes, President Carter convened them in Camp David and they helped hammer stuff out. But this was, remember, President Carter wanted to have an international peace conference in Geneva, and Israelis and Egyptians didn't want to have that. Jordan-Israel peace, President Clinton showed up in the Aro Desert to make it all happen, but it had already basically happened. And I think it's the same thing you could say about the Abraham Accords. It was something that was happening and then happened, and the United States is kind of the glue that makes it all, you know, puts the paper together or something, whatever metaphor you want to use.
So Fatima Hawaii asks, what about North Africa? What's the outlook on normalization with Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco?
It's interesting. Morocco's been mentioned in this conversation. I don't really detect these countries falling all over themselves to normalize relations. What's different is that they were unwilling to take a strong stance against the Emiratis and the Bahrainis. And then, you see the Saudis kind of laying down a marker saying Palestinian state, justice for the Palestinians. And then yesterday, the Kuwaiti prime minister made a very strong statement about how a state with Jerusalem as its capital, 67 borders and refugees was and will remain Kuwaiti policy. Now, Kuwait's not a huge player in inter-Arab councils, but it was a very, very strong statement in opposition to what the Emiratis and the Bahrainis have done with the consent, obviously, of the Saudis. So that may help countries like Tunisia or Algeria or Oman, which has a new sultan, to resist pressure to follow so quickly on the heels of the Emiratis and the Bahrainis.
Jason Berkovich, do you see normalization between the UAE and Bahrain with Israel to allow for increased investment by the UAE and Bahrain in the West Bank and Gaza?
Well, that's really something, it's really about the Emirates, because the Bahrainis are not a wealthy Gulf state. They have actually significant problems, and that's why I call them a wholly owned subsidiary of Saudi Arabia and partly the United Arab Emirates. The Emiratis have invested in the West Bank. They, not to the extent that the Turks or the Qataris have, but they have been there, and they've also been in Gaza. I think that primarily because of the bad relations between the Palestinian Authority and the United Arab Emirates, I think that it puts a brake on anything the Emiratis might want to do there. It also helps them by saying, look, if the Palestinian Authority is opposed to them, they, you know, throw their hands up and say, well, what are we supposed to do? And they can go merrily along in their relations with Israel, which is really the big enchilada. You know, Israel is a first world economy, a high tech hothouse. There's lots of things that the Emiratis and the Israelis can do separate from security, in technology, in healthcare, in a variety of things. The diamond and gold exchange alone is something that's important to both countries. So that's really where the Emiratis are focused. The problem is that the relationship between the Emiratis and the Palestinians is so raw, and that the Palestinian, and even though, you know, the Emiratis believe that they've done something very, very important for Palestine, and they haven't gotten the kind of response that they feel is commensurate with what they believe that they have done. So I don't really see the Emiratis going forward in a big way in the West Bank.
Well, one could make the argument, right, Stephen, that from the Palestinian point of view, normalization broke a major tenet that the Palestinians have counted on from the Arab world for time immemorial.
Without a doubt. And that is their argument. And their argument is, this has shattered the Arab consensus, which was already fraying, and it leaves us in a position where we're even weaker than we were before. And what kind of position does our Arab brethren leave us in? That is clearly the Palestinian position, and it's not wrong, but it also suggests to me that they might have been willing to take up this opportunity, however slim it might have been. You know, you have to kind of suspend reality to believe that, you know, this Israeli government is going to take up negotiations very quickly. But one can imagine a situation in which the Palestinians saying, oh, okay, you got the Abraham Accords, you've stopped annexation. Thank you so much, Mr. Crown Prince. Now help us. Provide us with some leverage with your new friends, the Israelis. We We take you at your word. You stopped annexation. Now help us with the next step. The United States hasn't been able to do that. All these other countries, the European Union hasn't been able to. You now have this new relationship that obviously the Israelis value. Help us with this. And they couldn't do it. I think they have a point. They have a very good point. They got, pardon me, screwed. It was something that I think was inevitable, but they could have tried. And I don't think that they really tried here.
Do you think that train has left the station for good? Or do you think there's still a possibility that they might change their approach and do exactly what you're suggesting to the Emiratis?
I'm the most cynical person in the world when it comes to the Middle East. I think that, of course, it is possible that the Palestinians could make a U-turn on this. I think going to the Turks was the worst possible thing that they could do. I think the best address for them to go to right now is Saudi Arabia, because you've got the king who remains steadfast in support and the crown prince who wants to explore relations with the Israelis. So they can work with both of them, actually, in a variety of ways. Whether they can recover with the Emiratis seems like it's going to be a tough road for them. And I don't know what the Emiratis would expect them to do or what the Palestinians even have to give on that front.
So pivoting to another region or a couple of other countries, back to one, Julie Lorido asked, what's going on between Turkey and Greece, and where do Israel and the U.S. stand on this?
That's a great question. And again, just to provide a little bit of context, the relations between Israel and Greece have really flowered over the course of the last 5 years or more. And as has Israel's relationship with Cyprus. And there is the development of relations between Israel, Cyprus, and Greece, and Egypt, Cyprus, and Greece. And that has turned into something called the Eastern Mediterranean Gas Forum, which is to cooperate in the exploration and exploitation of gas resources under the Mediterranean. It's also a security relationship, because all these countries have very difficult relations with Turkey. So the Israelis have been public in their support for Cyprus and Greece in the current conflicts, and let me emphasize that, conflicts with Turkey. Greece and Turkey have conflicts over the Aegean. They have conflicts over Greece is kind of protect Cyprus over Cyprus, and they have conflicts over a recent maritime agreement, boundary agreement that Turkey and Libya signed, which comes very close to the Greek island of Crete, Greece's largest island. And the Israelis have been very supportive of the Greeks. The United States has, and Secretary Pompeo has blessed the Eastern Mediterranean Gas Forum, but of course the United States is caught, because look at what's happening in the Eastern Mediterranean. A number of NATO allies, and France has supported the Greeks and the Cypriots, a number of NATO allies or non-NATO allies, strategic partners, are at opposite ends of the conflicts in the Eastern Mediterranean. And the United States has been motivated over many years to kind of make these conflicts go away and try to balance its relations with NATO, within NATO, between Greece and Turkey. And it has been manifestly unwilling and not really that interested in playing a role in the current conflicts. And that has left it to the Germans and others, and has provided an opportunity really for France to step up and take a leading role on behalf of Greece, which has created a very dangerous situation in the Eastern Mediterranean. And speaking of the Gulf, you have now, because of the threat that people perceive from Turkey, you have Greek and Emirati fighter jets conducting exercises together from this big military base on Crete. So it is a dangerous thing. There are negotiations between Greece and Turkey, but the fear is that these are negotiations that will temporarily reduce tensions and will go back to this cat and mouse game in the Eastern Mediterranean that could actually end up people shooting at each other just by mistake.
And just as a follow-up, if anyone wants to delve into this issue a little bit further, we just did a podcast on the Israeli angle on the Turkey-Greece crisis. So if you want to listen to more, go to Israel Policy Pod on our website. We have a question from Robert Goodkind, who's a member of our board. Please comment on maintaining Israel's qualitative military edge with the sale of F-35s to the UAE. Do you see the U.S. agreeing to diminishing some of the sophistication of the F-35s being delivered? And will such diminution be an issue for the Emiratis?
Yeah, it's a great point. And that's something that I'm not a guns and trucks kid, but in, you know, working on Egypt and, you know, what Egypt gets, I've learned that you can have two airplanes sitting next to each other that are both called an F-16, but that doesn't mean that they have the same capabilities. And so I think you're onto something here, that the Emiratis may get a version of the F-35 that doesn't have all the bells and whistles that they might want or that the Israelis might have. And that is a way, look, Israelis fly F-15s and so do the Saudis. There's an F-15I and there's an F-15SA. They're different machines. They look the same, they're called the same, but they're different things and they have different capabilities. And plus the Israelis are adept at modifying with their own technology American equipment. So I think that's probably the road that we're going down. I also think that the Israelis will likely be compensated in other ways with other military equipment or additional military equipment in response to what the Emiratis get. You know, it's very, very tough because the Emiratis have long been a very strong ally of the United States. The Emirati Air Force can fly with the U.S. Air Force at night. Not all our NATO partners, the United States permits to fly at night. That's a testament to that the Emiratis are pretty proficient. They have fought. They actually fought in Afghanistan. So there's a lot of trust between the U.S. military and the Emiratis. And so, you know, right now, on September 22nd, 2020, you know, you have to believe that within the U.S. defense establishment, no one really feels any kind of concern about providing the Emiratis with the equipment that they desire. But of course, we were supplying the Shah of Iran all kinds of equipment because no one could imagine an Iran without the Shah. Now, I'm not making the same argument, of course. The Emirates is very different societal structures, et cetera, et cetera. But there is, I think, that concern. But I think there are ways to address those concerns that will satisfy the Emiratis and that will satisfy the Israelis. Look, why do the Emiratis want this equipment? They feel very, very vulnerable to the Iranians. Very vulnerable to the Iranians. It has Iran has missiles that could level Dubai in a matter of minutes. And the Emiratis have sort of been caught unable to answer that. And that's why you see not just F-35, but things like long-range artillery, armed drones, and other types of things. I certainly believe they're going to get it. I think what's happening now is a kind of political theater that's happening, and the Israelis end up with a little more stuff, and the Emiratis basically get what they want.
Based on what you just said, Stephen, do you have concerns that additional normalization treaties will somehow spark an arms race in the Middle East as they all want goodies in return for normalization?
Well, you know, this is the unfortunate precedent that the Egypt-Israel peace treaty produced, is that anybody who signs a peace treaty is going to get hardware from the United States. That's what they want. And we are the biggest player in the Middle East arms bazaar. So yes, I think it does. And we have made it kind of a virtue. The president of the United States has talked about the beautiful arms that he sold to the Saudis. But those deals were negotiated by his predecessor as a way of reassuring the Saudis over the JCPOA and as a way of us kind of gradually stepping out of the region. This idea of retrenchment is really to give the countries in the region the tools to balance each other so that we don't have to be there to provide that stability. That's an experiment that kind of makes me a little nervous. And it does precisely what you say, Susie. I mean, everybody wants more stuff. And you get a lot of stuff already, but then you're going to get even more if you normalize relations, if you spend that night in Tel Aviv.
We got one more question and then I'm going to wrap it up, although we could go for another hour easily.
I'm just getting warmed up.
I'll certainly want you to come back. Roy Eisenberg asks, how do we square Israel publicly keeping Palestinians out of the Abraham Accords with today's less heralded but equally important establishment of the East Mediterranean Gas Forum, during which Energy Minister Steinitz explicitly included the Palestinians?
Look, there's a compartmentalization that's going on here. The Palestinians, and there's a geopolitical issue that's going on. But I think that everybody understands that you should include the Palestinians in the energy agreement, if only because it solves some of your problems in Gaza. And it's something that the Israelis have talked about, is that, you know, we have to relieve the situation in Gaza. We can't solve it, but we can do things to make it better. Then there's the other aspect of it, is that the Palestinians have sought, as I said before a couple of times, support from the Turks. The Turks are outside the Eastern Mediterranean Gas Forum. And so this is a way of kind of trying to split the Palestinians away from the Turks. You know, squaring it, I don't think anybody, I don't think this Israeli government or any Israeli government, when it comes to things like this, really needs to justify any of these kinds of things for themselves. There is an interest in having them in the Eastern Mediterranean Gas Forum. There's no interest in having them in the Abraham Accords. Zero, as they say.
Okay. Last question from Misha Koplovich. Do you think a Biden administration will put as much emphasis on having Arab states normalize with Israel outside of the Palestinian sphere?
It's a really good question. And I think that, you know, it's notable that the former vice president, welcomed the Abraham Accords and said that they were an important step forward in, you know, expanding peace in the region. There does seem to be a different emphasis within the Biden campaign as opposed to the Trump administration about seeking some sort of redress for the Palestinians. The argument being that these agreements, while good in and of themselves, is never going to bring the region to stability as long as the Palestinians remain outside of it, dispossessed, have no justice, no redress, and no ability to rule over themselves effectively. I mean, one of the really extraordinary things of where we are in the Middle East is that you have this kind of bizarro and truly unfortunate situation where you have this pantomime of statehood for the Palestinian Authority, protocol, and someone called a president, and so on and so forth, when they're not. They are almost beside the point at this point, which is extraordinary given where we were, I can't do the math, but this time of year in 1993.
27 years ago.
Thank you very much. It's because that's why I'm a qualitative political scientist, because I can't subtract. So it's a really unfortunate, I wrote about it a little bit recently in a big piece in Foreign Policy. It's macabre in ways, the situation that the Palestinians are in. So I do think that there will be more emphasis, these are done deals between the Israelis and the Emiratis and the Israelis and the Bahrainis, and some of the decisions that they have made and the decisions that the Palestinians have made are going to make it hard for a Biden administration to generate leverage with those states to help them on the Palestinian issue. And one has to question, you know, what are the tools that the United States is going to bring to bear on the Israelis, because these are things you can list 100 things, but those 100 things that no American president has ever been willing to bring to bear in this situation.
This has been really a tremendous conversation, Stephen. Thank you so much. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have today, but really appreciate your taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you, Susie. It was a real pleasure to be here. Your questions were great. The questions from those listening were wonderful. And I'd love to come back anytime you have use
of me. Well, we will definitely invite you back. And once again, I want to thank our supporters who are with us on today's call. Your generosity makes programs like this one possible. And again, if you've not already done so, please consider making a contribution at www.israelpolicyforum.org/giving. Thank you all once again for joining us today and, of course, for asking such great questions. And once more, I encourage you to subscribe to our podcast, Israel Policy Pod, and visit our website to access recordings of our previous briefings, as well as our special virtual event, The Road Ahead. We will be hosting another video briefing next Tuesday, September 29th, the day after Yom Kippur, at the regular time, 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific. Next week, we'll be hosting Khan News journalist Gal Berger for a retrospective on the Second Intifada, 20 years on. Remember, if it's Tuesday, it's an IPF webinar. Until then, be safe and be well. Shana Tova and Gemar Chatima Tova. Thank you all.